Welcome to Paradigm Shifters. My paradigm shifter today is truly taking on huge mountains in this world of yours and mine. Nadia McCaffrey lost a precious son in the Iraq War, but Nadia has always been a healer and a supporter of community. And what she's done to help the vets since her son passed has been mammoth, has been amazing, and has been, I always say, Nadia, welcome to the show. You belong on the stamp.
Oh, dear. Thank you. Okay. Well, I'll have to think about life. But
I know how hard you've worked to really support and touch the hearts of many people's lives who've been touched by these conflicts all around the world. It's just been incredible. So let's talk about that. Who are you and how did you get into that kind of thinking or being?
Who am I?
That's the question Ramana Maharshi used to ask everyone as a spiritual being. So that's a test, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am a near death experiencer, you know that. And I think pretty much everything that I have done, it was motivated by, you know, the strong guidance, yes, that I have had. And
your near death experience is when you were very young, wasn't it?
I was 7 years old when I had my first one, yes, and was bitten by a snake, a poisonous snake, and went into a coma. And yeah, when you go through something like this, you definitely have not just a sense, but you know what is right, what is wrong, what is true, what is not true. And you also lose the fear that most people have to live with.
I mean, it's about whether you're killed or whether you die or that sort of thing. You lose that fear.
It's a blend of things. It's it could be like I have no, you know, I can talk to anybody. I don't care who they are. I just if I say I'm going to say it, and I'm going to go straight up to them and say, okay, look, this is this and that. And many times it raises eyebrow, but I don't care. The point is, I have to say it. Mm-hmm. So this happened many times, actually.
Mm. So your near-death experience gave you a perspective of yourself in the world, or gave you a perspective over the whole world and the consciousness is beyond, or what?
General. It's what is right is right, what is wrong is wrong. There is some very, not too much gray space between right and wrong. There is, but I don't have to think twice about it.
Mm-hmm.
I just know, and if I make it my fight, well, I'm going to go for it, you know, to fix it.
Well, I'm very, very impressed. You're brave and you're focused. So let's go back into the war or the conflicts. I don't know how you feel, and I won't push you politically, but a lot of the conflicts are supposedly about security, and security is a really big issue these days, whether it's through the internet, you know, internet security, household security, and all of that. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Patrick went to Iraq to help build security for the U.S., didn't he?
No, actually, Patrick was not a military person. He was a National Guard, and he was not in the military before 9/11. He enlisted because of 9/11, and he enlisted because he wanted to help in the country. Mm. He was never planned. He had never planned to be deployed to Iraq in the middle of a war. Now, when the time came, we had a talk about this, a long talk actually, and finally he said, "Mom, you know, I signed that paper, and it's my duty. I have to go." But he didn't feel it was right, and he recognized that.
Oh, he didn't feel. See, that's good. The right-wrong thing is very important, isn't it?
Well, I never agreed, and many people with me, that the war in Iraq was motivated by any good reasons.
Yeah, good.
Uh-huh. I could agree have with been you. Afghanistan, but I did not see Iraq. I still don't. And what have we fixed?
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, of course, it generated this war just created more and more terrorism and dark forces. I mean, it's just what it is. And unfortunately, my grandson, Patrick's son, is in the middle of the ISIS fight over there.
Oh, my gosh.
So I have to leave it with, you know, hoping and praying for him that he's going to come out of this in one piece. But, yeah, it's ongoing. And I think, you know, to come to the core of the whole situation, since 9/11, we have lost our sense of security and our focus on ourselves. We've lost so much to fear and to war that, but once we have to, I think the fear is in each one of us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel it. I'm blessed because I don't feel that way. But I think it starts, but you know, by becoming fearless within each one of us.
I've noticed that that, for example, with the Brussels stuff, the ISIS things that are going on, there's a lot of internet reports saying people are praying into it, loving the people rather than reacting. You're kind of talking on that level, aren't you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I want my, you know, what I would love to see. Really, instead of creating more fear and more destruction and more war, for people to realize that violence doesn't do any good except bring more violence. I mean, it's a fact, always been proven. Mm-hmm. And now we're in the middle of all of this and we don't know how to stop it.
What does your grandson say?
He just turned 21 years old. He was in college for 3 months, and we had quite a few talks on this, and he admitted that he was going to finish college and maybe enlist because he wanted to follow his father's steps, and I tried to explain to him, that's not why your father enlisted. He enlisted because he did not want you to do that, what he had to do.
Mm.
He wanted you to be safe because that's what he did. He sacrificed himself for you and us.
But he is a boy, man. Isn't that kind of as far back as the Bhagavad Gita and these ancient spiritual texts? It's like the warrior has to do something. And I kind of see those, the impetus in many, many people thinking they're going to go out and be a hero. And this is a really, really difficult situation, isn't it, to contend with a 21-year-old.
Right. It was kind of funny because he pulled himself, he just stopped college and enlisted with the Marine. He didn't tell me. I found out on Facebook.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
And he didn't know how to tell me. And he told a friend of mine, and first thing she said, did you tell your grandma? And he said, no, I think she's mad at me. Well, that was, you know, I saw this and I was shocked. I was not mad, I was shocked. And then I didn't really know how to approach the situation, so I just posted something on his Facebook page saying, I love you no matter what. I respect your decision. I don't agree with it, but I love you no matter what. And he called me up just after, and at least he understands that I always will be here for him.
Mm-hmm. That's really important. It's really been, that's a really difficult thing for you, and you still have the chutzpah to keep going forward and making a difference. And is Patrick Jr., is he in touch? Does he tell you how it is over there? Does he think he's doing the right thing? Or
they can't really talk about it, especially a Marine.
Oh, of course. Yeah, that's right.
No, nothing much at all. But he managed to call once in a while, whenever he can. And he does FaceTime so I can see him. And I know when something is wrong. He doesn't have to tell me.
Right.
He's going through some very tough time, and he's learning very, very fast. but he's strong, you know. He's like his dad. He has a lot of character and strength. On the other hand, he's naive. So it's a blend of things that are going to be the man who he's becoming.
Mm-hmm. It must be hard to be, for any of them over there, to see who's the enemy and who, you know, we're all one. And it's really, with it so divided because of politics or some sort of land grab or resources and so on, it must be fairly hard for them to really understand who's the enemy. Is it?
It's not like Iraq when Patrick was there, mm-hmm. after his father. It's a different kind of a war now because it's ISIL or ISIS, and they know pretty much what they have to face and what they are facing in a different way. I don't know. This place is so, there is nothing left. You know, it's everything has been destroyed. There, nothing much is standing anymore. It's become a huge desert.
Is that heartbreaking?
Yeah, of course it is.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I just think it's really interesting to think of a personal response to it. And I guess he's growing up a lot. There's some tremendous learning that he has to do. And his mother must be going through a lot too, eh?
Oh, I remember what I went through when Patrick was deployed. Yes, of course.
Yes, of course. So what's really interesting about you, one of the many things, is that you're also an intuitive, right?
Well, I don't claim that. I have things that come to me and visions and things like that. Yeah, and because of my near-death experience, too. Mm-hmm. I can, yeah, but I don't know. The way you say it sounds very professional, you know, and it's not at all what...
Well, are you willing to discuss the fact that you actually get messages from your son?
Oh, yeah, yes.
Well,
go ahead.
No, that I just think that's really interesting. And you're right, you don't have to be a professional intuitive for that. But you are very well connected with realms of consciousness. I know that, right?
Okay. Yeah. It's a very important part of my life. I kind of visualize myself and feel myself as having a foot on this dimension and one on the other behind the veil, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of self going, especially when I meditate. I can take a very high level now where I basically disconnect with my body, and it's interesting what comes out of this. But Patrick, communication, yeah, communicating with he you heard the story before where I found my other grandson. It came in a dream.
Oh, yeah, tell people about that. They didn't hear it. I haven't passed that beautiful story on.
Yeah, that was 2010. And the very, just about the day or the day before Patrick's memorial every year, when I live in Tracy, I used to have we all used to have a memorial for Patrick, and that was kind of a tradition, still is. And I had a dream, which was more like a vision dream, not a dream, but I was living it. So you know the difference between something that you are part of and a dream that you can see kind of at a distance. You know, it's not present. But this was, and it was the same dream for, it came three times, few days apart. And the first time it was Patrick in uniform, and he was kind of annoyed, his face was, and he said to me, "Mom, my son." And I just went away. So I woke up, and the first thing I did, I thought about it, and I called my grandson.
Okay.
And I called everybody to make sure everybody was okay. They were. Okay, the second time, the same dream occurred, but this time he was more annoyed than the first time. And he said, "Mom, my son." Okay. I woke up and I said, Patrick, what the heck do you want from me? I mean, everybody seems to be okay. I don't understand what you want from me. So I called again, you know, just made sure that everything was okay. And, okay, the night before the memorial of Patrick's anniversary of death, the dream came again. But this time it was so much stronger. And he was really in my face. And he was saying, Mom, my son. So I just sat on my bed and said, my goodness, what's going on? I don't understand this. Something is happening here. Yeah, I didn't pass the day that I got a phone call from someone I didn't know, a young voice. And this young voice was crying and sobbing, and I could hardly understand what he was saying to me. And he was like, I want to talk to you. I found you on a website, and I didn't know who I was. Now I found you, so I want to meet you. Maybe you don't want to meet me. Okay. Just like a chaos. And I said, whoa, hold on. First of all, who are you? Well, he said, I'm your grandson anyway, but I... And then he went on again. I said, you what? And he said, yes, I'm your grandson. You're not junior. No, I'm not junior, but I'm your grandson. I need to talk to you. Okay. So I say, okay, let's start all over again.
Starting all over, yes.
Yeah. So here it is. A young man that is Patrick's son. Patrick never met him, didn't know he existed. His mother and he and Patrick used to go out. He was already starting college, and she was in a last year of high school, I think. And they went, you know, along for quite a few months, maybe a year. I don't remember how long that lasted. But I remember her very well. They used to come to the house in Sunnyvale. And I don't know. One day I didn't see Monique. So I asked Patrick, I said, what happened to Monique? Where is she? He said, oh, Mom, don't ask. Okay, so I didn't ask for a few days. And then I said, I like Monique. Where is she? How come she's not coming anymore? And he said, Mom, we broke up. Okay, I let go. And that was basically it. Monique and her mother moved away and never heard from her again. When she told my grandson, his name is Florentino, because Florentino grew up not knowing who his father was. And when he turned 18, she finally told him. So that's how it started. That's how he started to look for his father. And, of course, by the time he got to me, Patrick was already dead. So he was totally distraught. And, you know, he was unbelievably changed.
Had he started looking for Patrick before he died?
No, he didn't know who he was.
Okay.
But so the next day after this, they came to the house, both of them. And, of course, I recognize Monique. And Florentino looks so much like Patrick.
Oh, wow.
It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. And the same heart. They like the same food.
Ah.
That was amazing. So we're staying very close to each other. And then Florentino asked me, Grandma, can we do a DNA test? Because I want this to be, you know, public and sure. So we did, and the test came back. He's 99.9999% sure that it's Patrick's son.
Oh, that brings tears to my eyes. And you like this child now. He's not a child, but do you like him? Yeah.
I love him. He's precious.
And you sort of know him. It gives me goosebumps.
I never met him before.
No, but don't you know him when you're with him now? It's like it seems like there's a real no, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we can. Yes, there is a deep knowledge, understanding, closeness, yes.
Oh, that's wonderful. So was Patrick relieved? Did he respond? Was he relieved to hear?
Yes, he didn't come back the same way at all. You know, he's always in and out of my life. And when I don't hear from him too much, I worry because I don't like it. I don't know if I could make it here without knowing that he's watching over me and over all of us, his son mainly. You know, the whole family needs him.
But it's really, it's interesting, isn't it, that he can have, that Patrick is having a healing impact on his family, is he not? And that's a pretty big healing there. Uh-huh.
Yeah, absolutely. He's done so many. Patrick was, I used to say that Patrick was a gentleman, which he was. He had such a big heart, you know, for everybody. Like the last day of his life, 2 hours before he was shot and killed, he saved 3 lives.
Wow.
And he didn't, it was 125 degrees that day.
Oh my gosh.
And he didn't take any rest. He was making sure everybody had water. He evacuated 3 people, and that's, you know, saved their lives. The ambush happened, and there were only 3 Americans left.
But it's interesting, wasn't the ambush done by the people that they were actually helping?
Well, yes and no. See, a lot of things have unfolded. I know from the start that the ICDCs were involved in the ambush, which were the Iraqi soldiers. But there was an investigation that the military closed in 2006. They never told me the truth up until 2006. And they told me because I raised a big fuss with Barbara Boxer, stating that, well, yeah, they wouldn't give me the report of his death. I was refused to receive the report of his death and the autopsy report. I wanted to know everything about his death. I wanted to know if he suffered, mainly.
Right.
But I also wanted to know how many times he was shot and, you know, the whole thing around it. Well, they say no. So Boxer got involved, and a month later, I had General Hillman to my doorstep with 3 officers directly from the Pentagon with all the reports.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was 2006. And when I got home that day, there was 5 satellite truck waiting in front of the house. I couldn't get in. And actually, the street was blocked with the big CNN truck and everything.
Oh, wow, really? Wow.
Yeah.
That's when I used to see you on TV all the time in those days.
Yeah, I was quite a bit in the media. Anyway, things, you know, unfolded. And I didn't quit on it. I really didn't let go. Mm-hmm. But that was 2006, and actually it was for his anniversary of death that they came to the house.
Wow.
The day. And General Hillman wanted to come the exact day of Patrick's anniversary. I said, no, you're not. And he said, why not? I said, because I don't want to see your face when the day my son is dead for his anniversary. You'll come the day after.
Okay.
And he did.
Oh, good. So it was respectful.
He didn't feel like to face him that day.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's how it went.
Well, let's go back to when there was some big changes you've made in the community of the military. So when your son and others were killed, you demanded that they be brought into a bigger airport. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. We started to do a lot of shaking and moving around because the way Patrick got home was through a cargo flight from Delta Airline that was supposed to arrive at 9 o'clock at night, and the media was there to welcome my son, but it was forbidden. You could not film flag draped coffin or take pictures of it at the time. But I didn't care about that. I just wanted to have. I wanted everybody to know who Patrick was. He did not left the country in darkness. I did not wanted him to come in darkness. So the thing is that the media waited from 9 o'clock until finally when he arrived was past midnight. They stood there. And when Patrick arrived in that flight, again, it was a cargo flight. that unloaded the coffin in the warehouse. Why?
Why?
Do we do that? I mean, is that respectful to receive somebody who gave his life for his country in a warehouse?
No, it seems like they're ashamed, right?
Well, I wasn't.
No, no, not you, the whoever's bringing them back.
But precisely.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, for the first time, the media was there, and this went everywhere. I mean, that was like a fire.
Right.
It just, you know, I don't know if you remember, but yeah.
I do, anyway, and I'm so proud of you. That's why I'm so proud of you. Yeah.
Well, you know, in 2009, President Obama canceled the ban.
Oh, really?
It doesn't exist anymore.
Good. Oh, okay, so they just bring them in now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that things have changed, and not just that, but they have a special flight for them now.
Oh, thank you. Oh, so much more. It's just wonderful. I mean, it's so much better. It doesn't sound important, but it always just really makes my heart expand. So you were successful in that, and it didn't stop there. You've done some amazing stuff to help the vets. So tell us about, for example, what's going on with the vets? It just seems like they don't get the support they need, but I know with your work, they are getting some of it, aren't they?
Well, they don't get the support they need, no, but it has changed. They certainly get much more support today than they did in 2004 and 5.
Okay.
In 2004, they did not have a voice. You did not talk about PTSD. You did not talk about TBI publicly. Because if you did that, then it would go against your record and you may not get your benefit.
Oh, wow. Terrifying.
Yeah. Stigma. So, you know, I started to fight for this in 2006. And when I was in the media so much, I took some of the veterans that asked me to help. And most of them at the time were Patrick's unit.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, because they had such a big loss. They are one of the most wounded units from all wars. I mean,
oh, wow.
The Middle Eastern War. So the one of the first one was Steve, and he was in the middle of the fighting over there. He came back, and he was, you know, he had a family. He wanted to be with family and so on and so on, getting on with his life. He couldn't react. He couldn't work. He couldn't even going outside his house. His PTSD was so bad, and he had flashbacks. So I remember him calling at 3 o'clock in the morning, and what he did that day, he locked himself in his bedroom, put the dresser in front of the door, and he picked up the phone because he was becoming violent, he felt.
Okay.
And he was afraid to hurt someone. So he called me. I kept him on the phone for a couple hours. And I realized very clearly that I had to do something that same night. And I did. Even at the time, you know, being so late, I called people everywhere, Los Angeles, San Diego, Nassau, California, to get him out of the house and take him somewhere in a retreat so he could unfold and unwind and make a sense of understanding on what was happening with him.
Mm-hmm.
We did that.
Of a retreat exists for that? I'm sorry, go ahead. I want to hear the story, but I want to know about the retreat too.
Well, at the time, there was nothing much, but you heard of Thich Nhat Hanh, of course.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, Thich Nhat Hanh had a pupil for somebody that study and work with him. His name is Paul Anshan Thomas.
Okay.
And Paul Anshan Thomas happens to be a Vietnam veteran. But he's also a Buddhist monk. So that's how he fought his own PTSD. And he has his own, you know, organization, if you like. It's all part of nature. And at the time, he was promoting or starting retreats in Oregon, in the woods.
So this is like meditation retreats and getting into nature, both things.
Yes, but the fact that he was a combat Vietnam veteran, they didn't have to explain to each other, you know, the new vets and he, know what they are going through and understood. But he could explain to them why the reaction, why this, why that. And when they feel the flashback or the losing control, they can feel it coming and do something about it. For Steve, it made a big difference because he finally understood what was happening to him, and he could have, you know, what Paul Anshan Thomas did with his work, with him, the calm, the nature. That's where the farming came from, actually, later. But he realized how much more tools he had to fight against PTSD. And he, it's a matter of fact, Stephen also has traumatic brain injuries.
Oh, really? From that conflict?
Yeah, he was ejected from his Humvee.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So when people can see them and understand them, it makes it easier to get in step and really help heal some of this, does it?
Yes, but it doesn't heal.
Okay.
It never goes away. It's something that you have to learn how to live with.
Oh, I see. I guess I didn't realize that. That's a tragedy, eh? And so with the government supporting it?
Yeah. Since 2004 and 5, a lot of changes have been made with treatment. There is so much more resources available today, including the VA. So it's been finally recognized. And again, Stephen was one of the very first veterans to speak openly and publicly about PTSD. And I took him with me on today's show and Good Morning America, I think.
Oh, good.
And also many, many major newspapers.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So he's kind of a pioneer. But at the time when we started working with that, you just didn't talk about it.
Right. People must have said, so you're really quite a strong-willed character. Good for you, Nadia. Hey?
Well, the thing is that, you know, I spoke a lot publicly, I mean, here, Europe and everywhere. But one of the things that I always remind veterans is never to forget that they have a voice and they need to have that voice being heard. They need to speak out.
Right.
If they don't, how do they expect the change to happen? They need to, you know, that's why the Farmer Veterans Coalition was started.
So what is the Farmer Veterans Coalition? Tell me about that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, the Farmer Veterans Coalition was started in 2007, 2008 in Santa Cruz in a small strawberry farm just by the ocean. There was a group of farmers and there was a group of veterans and three Gold Star mothers. I was one of them. And the farmer and the veteran were in trouble because the farmer didn't, that was the time where they were cutting off people working in farms from Mexico. I don't know if you remember.
I do, yes. Yeah.
So many farms ended up having no resources to harvest their farm and work the farms. So the farm were going down and the group of farmers was there. Three of them were homeless. Or, you know, kind of bouncing from one place to the next without having a home. So I listened to all of this, and I sat on the podium and said, look, guys, you need to work with each other.
Good.
See, the farmer has to open their home or their door to the farm, to the veteran, and veteran needs to work with the farmer and learn how to do that.
Mm.
So that bring jobs, that bring housing, and blending the whole thing together, well, pretty soon the vision came that, you know, if you have a piece of land, you can build a roof, mm-hmm. and you can have a family, and you can become self-sufficient. And today, the Farmer Veterans Coalition is all over the country.
Yay!
It started with, you know, this group, but attracted a lot of interest. Pretty soon we had the first conference in New York, in Manhattan, And with our first veteran, who is now living in Davis, is in his own farm. He was in Iraq. And he loved to watch the Iraqi farmer grow their crops and what have you. And he became very interested by that. He was not a farmer or from a farmer family. He was actually, he grew up in a big city. But he realized that farming was bringing peace to him. And farming and growing plants is the opposite of war.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, and he said, and I never forgot it.
That's beautiful. So you're saying that this started and it grew like mad, like the gardens did, and the people have, it's become a very viable place for veterans to go and get a position in the world, a job?
Yeah. It's not a place. It's their place.
Mm-hmm.
It's the main office is in Davis,
okay,
California.
Well, they have quite a big agricultural program in Davis, too, don't they?
Yes, they do. But they have their own farmer department, the farmer veteran department in Washington, D.C. now.
Wow.
Anyway, it went so wild that it's not limited to think about farming. What do you see? When you say farming, it used to be kind of a bad word because it was associated before years. I'm talking about years and years ago. With dirt farmer, poverty, you name it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Forget that. That's not what it is about. This is the standard view of people who don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Farming today can be farming oyster, growing oysters. Mm-hmm. You can be an aquaponic farmer and a green, with huge greenhouse, small greenhouse. You can bring in a parking lot in Los Angeles, enough food to feed 10 families.
Right.
Pretty much years around. You can grow flowers. You can have a farm of a dairy farm. I mean, you name it.
Right. And it's the sustenance for, it's the bread, we're the breadbasket for a lot of places. What about organics and stuff? Do they get into all that?
That's all it is.
Good. Okay. Thank you.
That's pretty much all it is.
Mm-hmm.
But if you see it closely, it's the opposite of corporation. This is a chance to raise a family. We have, you know, we send people to college. There are a lot of grants available. The USDA is on our side now.
Okay, good. That's nice. Eh?
I mean, it's huge. The accomplishment that they have come, and this is thanks to Michael O'Gorman. Michael was there day one, and he's still there today. He took them all the way.
Wow. And was he also a vet?
No, he's a father of a vet.
Okay. So you have these people with really strong hearts that are really pushing forward. Whilst we're talking about this, tell me about the Veterans Village, because is that part of the same thing, or is that a different movement?
No, it's part of the same thing in a way. It started with it. I mean, the Veterans Village, I started in 2006, and that's the time where Farmer Veterans Coalition was being created. Mm-hmm. It went to a different name at first. The first name of it was Farm Not Arms, and that's the farmer that where we were, you know, that was a group of people that were there for it. That's where it took birth. The birth happened there. The idea that I had that day was not because of me, but because of my French grandfather. He did World War One. He was wounded twice in Verdun, came home. He owned five farms and had people working farms for him. But he recognized many things. He had shell shock, you know, PTSD was called shell shock then, and he couldn't function sometimes. So what he would do, he would just take off in the land and come back at night. And he was fine. He was healing. It was what saved his life. And he told me that many times. And when I saw this farmer and veteran sitting in that small place in Santa Cruz, that's who I thought of. My grandfather.
Well, then, wow, that's wonderful. What a legacy, eh? Souls kind of grow. But when you were doing the villages, my memory is that you had some land donations, or you had some real cooperation with your plea or with your quest, did you not?
Yeah, a lot of things happen over the years. One thing that people have to understand, I never did anything for me. Everything that I did is for veterans and people.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not interested in acquiring things for me. You know, that's why I'm here today. I mean, you know, where I am at this point in my life. The most bitter project that we talk about again today is the project in Guerneville. This was a very sad thing that has happened.
Guerneville.
We had a donation of actually magnificent building that was 4-story tall, completely new, was not completely finished actually, by a veteran, a World War II veteran, donated that to us. And we were going to turn this into the first second home for veteran, which means that, you know, send them to college, find jobs, treatment for PTSD, seminar, workshop, whatever, to get them back into life, civilian life. Everybody was supporting the project, actually was on television many times. Dan Rather did a big documentary on the whole story. Not just that, but Patrick's story. And so part of that.
Dan Rather? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Wow, good.
Good.
Yeah, it's a 2-hour documentary.
Wow.
Anyway, everybody was supporting the project except 5 people turned against it. 2 quit, 3 were left. And they were decided to demolish this. So they would not have veterans with PTSD opening in their neighborhood.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And they succeeded, sadly. So this, here we are. They managed to have the building red tagged, and we couldn't finish it. We couldn't open it. We couldn't do anything with it.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That was 2008. It was... That made the media big times. I mean, it was on every page you can think of, including Military Time, Maritime, Navy Time, all the military newspapers had it.
I mean, the fact that it was demolished was everywhere.
What?
The fact that it was demolished, you mean, that was everywhere?
They did not demolish anything.
Oh.
It just stood up. It was not completely built. I mean, there was some window missing, very minor things, but the building itself was done. They red tagged it and closed it.
Hmm.
We could not go in or out.
Hmm. So what happened?
It's still there, closed.
Closed. Isn't that awful? So it's a kind of a political thing, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Tell me this, several ways that I want to jump with this. Does Patrick give you suggestions or inspiration to do these things, to have the will and courage to start a new project, or maybe the idea of a new project? Does he do some of that?
Yes. He is, how could I say? I will know, and I mentally, he let me know. I don't know how to explain this to people. It's number one. But yes, definitely he has his input. And some very clear sign come down when something is about to happen. If it's no, I'm not going to discuss why, you know, I just won't do it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, he's very present. And I usually am aware of where I am going. If something like Guerneville does not succeed, there is another purpose behind it. See, because Guerneville kind of promoted other projects.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea behind it is now everywhere. It's a movement. It's become a movement.
Mm-hmm. So knowing all about it promoted a movement, actually. So it wasn't just the Guerneville thing, as if it had succeeded. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. And there was another project where we worked there for 4 years to open a center in Minnesota. Well, it was amazing. This project it still is, but we didn't have the money to buy the whole thing. We needed $5 million, and we didn't have that. So we keep working with legislator, even the governor of just about everybody in Minnesota, and everybody wanted the place to open and be done. I was not doing anything there for me. It's for veteran. So from one step to the next, quite a few big organizations try to connect with us and bring the funding, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Except that a couple of them that showed where, we had conference calls regularly. And I realized once they didn't know that I was on a call and I was listening to those CEO talking to each other, all they were interested in discussing on that call were their salaries.
Oh, you're kidding. Oh, my gosh. Of course, I shouldn't say I'm surprised. Isn't that kind of what happens a lot?
Yeah. Well, they didn't know I was on the call. And then I finally, spoke up and I say, how dare you?
Were they scared? Scared of you?
Oh, that was a big silence.
I'll bet you.
Yeah.
I bet
yeah.
you. Wow, that was that kind of distressing for you. I bet you it was a little heartbreaking, huh?
No. I was furious.
Mm.
And I learned, everybody learned. Anyway, they were pretty much out.
Wow.
They actually retrieved themselves, when they realized it was a pure project, for a veteran, not to make profit out of or money out of.
But the project continued, though, hey?
Yes, the project is now open, and not completely open, but open. There is, I don't know, about 20 veterans there. They have horses and quite a few things going on. It's not run the way we had the vision, but it's there and open.
Well, I want to jump back to something. When you're talking about Guerneville, and you said they didn't want these people with PTSD in their neighborhood, and you and I recently talked about this, that I think a lot of us, and I want you to give us a little guidance here, if you will, a lot of us are a little nervous about some vets or homeless people because there sometimes is a rage that you can trigger that you don't know you're triggering, you know what I mean? And how do we handle people? Because a lot of us have big hearts and want to be of service, so... what can we do to get along with these people and help them integrate or make their lives redeemable for themselves?
Yes, it's a very good question, and people don't know. If you don't work or have no connection with homelessness, then you're not going to make the difference between this and that. My experience comes from the first time I worked with homeless people was in Santa Cruz at the Armory, and I volunteered once a month to cook one huge meal that took me all day to cook, actually, and bring that in my VW van to them at night. There was 90 people, usually 90, 92 people the time I did that, and I was going there alone at night. I never was afraid once, and when they got used to me the first time, they were not sure, but the second time, they were there in line waiting for my van to help me unload, and I sat there, ate with them, talked to them, and listened to their story, and that's how I learned who they were. This was the 90s, the early 90s. You remember at the time, many people were losing their businesses, houses. I thought that was a big turnaround in our economy.
You bet. Yes, I remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So many people, for some of the people who were there homeless, it's because they had lost everything. But their goal was to get back, into a decent life of some sort. And then you had another group of people there who were what we call now chronic homeless. And what it is, there is some mental illness attached to that sometimes, but they feel more comfortable in the street, living in the streets, surviving in the streets, than being part of society. And some of them have made some very interesting living. And yeah, you have to be kind of careful. For example, when I live in Tracy does not have much homelessness at all. But there was one man that was where I used to shop pretty much every day, and it was a big sign, veteran, no food, no work, whatever. So I one day he intrigued me. I stopped and I say, I don't want to give you money. I want to talk to you. And I say, okay, first of all, are you a veteran? And he say, yes, I am. I say, go show me. And he say, what? He say, well, show me that you're a veteran. You have some paper, you have something. Oh, he said, no, I don't have my papers, this and that. I say, are you a veteran? I repeated my question. He say, no, I'm not. So what?
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah, you have this kind. Okay, so every time I saw him, I say, what are you doing here? You better not have that veteran sign again. And he never got the veteran back again. He never had veteran, the word veteran, on his, board.
Good.
Yeah.
But doesn't that tell you, like, it's scary for a lot of people who want to be a Pollyanna or do-goods or something, and it's scary to be duped because you just don't know. I don't know all the time, and I'm a pretty good intuitive. I don't know how to tell who's going to punch
me. Well, you can if you observe. But this particular, to finish what I was, the reason I brought him up, is because this, he was part of an organization.
Oh.
And he was alone. He had a woman and two teenagers who were working with him, different places. They collected the money and went back in different spots in the city.
Hmm. So they and were actually, just doing it as a job?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You have this, and then you have also a veteran from Vietnam who never could readapt because they didn't have treatment, because they have PTSD, because, of course, there are some major issues attached to, their service. And unfortunately, they are very difficult to remain, to take off the streets because of the time they spend there, because of being used to be abused practically.
Mm-hmm.
They do need help, but they don't know how to get help. If you, sometimes you try to look at them in the face, in the eyes, and you can't do that because they always look down.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a sign, that they've been beaten, and it's a very difficult spot. I'm not saying they can't get over it, no, but it's critical that, and the new veteran from OIF, OEF, Afghanistan and Iraq, you will not find them in the street.
Oh, okay.
Very rarely you will find one in the street.
And that's because they have some supports now or because people understand? No.
They do have support, but it's not the reason. They don't mix with the rest.
Oh, I see.
They live in their car. If they lose a car, they will hide someplace.
Okay.
It's new to them. So they don't have yet the seasoning, of the old, the people who have been there for years.
Mm.
And it's also a conflict, a territorial thing. People who have been in street for long time have their territory.
Yes, I know that. That's amazing, isn't it? That's really vicious. Well, so I want to jump into another thing because we're going to be over pretty soon and I haven't got everything from you that we want to hear, So what do you think of war now? Do you think we're ever going to rise above it? What do you, how do you respond to ISIS? And you said earlier not to be afraid because that brings up reaction, right?
Yeah. Okay. One thing, if you don't mind, I would like to close for the homeless part of it.
Sure. Yeah.
Personally, I don't give them money.
Okay.
But one thing that will make them feel good and that you care is you know, look at them in the face, give them a smile, giving something to eat or something they can use. Like for women, I have a little set of, I buy bags like at the Goodwill and something and fill them up with a towelette, toothpaste, toothbrush, Kleenexes, hygiene things. You know, give them that. No talk, just give it. Mm-hmm. And this will be more appreciated if you have any idea.
Oh, wow. That's good to know. That's really good to know.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, going back to your question.
Yeah, I'm just really interested in the whole war thing, and I would really love to see us rise above it. Because I see these people, and I go, why? Well, anyway, it's a huge question, and I realize that. So what do you think about ISIS or the rest of it?
Well, it's like a cancer, you know. It was started with the Bush administration when we went to Iraq. That's where it started. Mm-hmm. It was not that yet, but it became that now. Mm-hmm. And this cancer is growing, and we kind of fed it, you know, we created it. We don't know how to get rid of it. And it's not going to be over soon.
It's really something, isn't it?
Yep.
Wow. So do you think it would help if we build a wall?
Oh, dear.
I had to throw that in, didn't I?
Yeah. Talk to Trump.
Yeah. So, Nadia McCaffrey, you really are an amazing woman. You've made such a huge difference. And I think one of the things that you're really doing is helping people open their hearts and see that one person can make a difference. You have to get angry and forceful sometimes, but you're doing it. I'm proud of you. That's great.
Thank you. Can I say one last thing?
Of course, you can say two last things.
Well, whoever listens today, just remember, as long as you care for others, as long as you love each other, as long as you know that you can make a difference, even with your neighbor, or very little things, it doesn't have to be big things, but that will make a difference and grow, because people will see you do it and will copy you, and that's how it goes.
I love that. Thank you for that. And give people your website or some place they could be in touch with you.
Well, my old website is veteransvillage.org.
Okay.
There is no space, no dot, just one word, veterans with an S, village.org. And I have 10 Facebook pages.
You're a busy woman.
Yeah, from consciousness to veteran. So you're welcome to contact me anytime. My information and contact are on the contact page on the website. And I never lose hope, and I always will love.
Ah, we always feel your love. This is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you to my guest, Nadia McCaffrey, and thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, this is being podcasted fairly widely, so you can help yourself to this interview and learn more about how to work with vets or even just how to have the stamina to do life-changing projects. Many blessings.